Coming up on Weekend America.
To stay on top in the crime world, you got to look out for number one.
As a mobster, you gloat in your ferocity and the way people respect you or they fear you. I mean, you love the attention. You can put a mobster in a stadium and his ego will fill up that whole stadium.
This weekend, a former mobster comes clean and confesses to America. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe. For some, food is both sustenance and inspiration.
I love bread of all forms. Bread in stick form, bread in roll form, croissant bread, muffin bread, and regular sliced bread.
It's the last weekend of Poetry Month. New Yorkers turn to menus to find their muse. But inspiration to break convention does not always come like you'd expect.
The idea to have 23 strings on a banjo was not a single light bulb moment.
You gotta hear this on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
In St. Paul, Minnesota, it's Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe, in for Bill Radke. Coming up this hour, here's some words you don't often hear together. Progressive, experimental, banjo music. Paul Metzger is spending this weekend expanding the frontiers of a pretty traditional instrument, and he's adding just a ridiculous amount of new strings to his banjo as well. So, okay, that's Paul. What about you? What are you doing this weekend?
Ride my motorcycle.
Some cookout, some swimming.
Actually, I've got yard work to do, so I plan to be working outside in the yard.
On Saturday, I'm volunteering at a kids family fest here in Chapel Hill.
I'm planning on sitting inside in the basement of the library and studying for finals for law school.
It's my birthday this weekend, so I've got three different restaurants I'm going to. Sushi, a surprise, and then I was just reading one in the paper called Maru. New restaurant here in Chicago.
Sushi, Maru. Sounds like he's got a Japanese theme going on. Unless that surprise is a Mexican restaurant.
Or perhaps a Mexican-Japanese surprising restaurant. Those voices came to us from Chicago, Chapel Hill, and St. Paul.
We start off this hour with a story about transformation. It's the story of Rene Enriquez. Until 2002, Rene was one of the kingpins of the violent crime syndicate, the Mexican Mafia. He's currently serving a 20-years-to-life sentence for murder, and for ordering another killing, he's serving a concurrent 15-years-to-life sentence. Rene spent 10 years in the Security Housing Unit of Pelican Bay State Prison. The Security Housing Unit, or called the SHU, is solitary confinement. It's where the worst of the worst are sent. Even with no windows, no cellmates, and limited contact with the outside world, he was still able to keep dealing drugs and live the life of a mobster. In May of 2002, Rene decided to quit. And not only that, he gave Mexican Mafia secrets to law enforcement. That got him out of the SHU, but he's still in prison. Rene told his story to Michael Montgomery, who produced an audio documentary for American Radio Works. It's called Gangster Confidential, and is playing on many public radio stations this weekend. Michael will join us in a moment, and so will Rene from his lockup. We're not allowed to say where he's calling from. They're going to talk to us about Rene's decision to become a government source. But first, here's a clip of Rene when he had just been transferred to a prison near the Mojave Desert.
I can come out here and walk without my shoes, with my feet on the grass now. I can come out and see the mountains every morning when I come to breakfast. I can come to the yard and bask in the sun and get a tan. You know how pale I was when I came down from Pelican Bay? We looked like vampires. That's what we call each other. You look like a darn vampire because you have no exposure to the sun at all. You have no direct exposure to the sun.
So, Rene, when you recorded that, you'd already become a government source. You'd made it out of the SHU, which is solitary confinement. And you'd sounded so happy in that less restricted environment. And yet we find out later that you were actually high during that interview. Why?
You know, I think it was a facade, really. I mean, I was regretting my decision for having left. And I was at a place where I felt I was lost and abandoned. You know, I go from this individual with this great amount of respect and an awesome amount of power to just becoming a regular Joe. And I had never been a regular Joe all my life. And naturally, without cognitive and behavioral therapy, I regressed right to what I knew again, which was associating with individuals in the same subculture and participation in, you know, narcotics use and dealing drugs. That's what I knew best.
Michael, I'd imagine your position as a documentarian was not unlike law enforcement in that here's Renee giving you information that you have to trust. How do you learn to trust what he says over time?
I did not actually know that Renee was high during that interview for some time. And I think that's a good thing, because had I known that day or the day after that he was high and that he was using drugs and really getting caught up in this group of gang dropouts dealing drugs, I think I would have walked away from the project. But it didn't happen that way. And in fact, the very act of Renee revealing this to me showed to me that he was moving out of that mafioso, tough guy, no weaknesses mentality. And actually, I think that that was a very, very critical moment in our work together. The other question was, you know, where he was heading. Was he going to continue to evolve and go in a positive direction, or was he going to have another relapse? And I think that was a concern, my concern, and also a concern for law enforcement.
Renee, let me ask you, by cooperating with the government, by telling your story to Michael, you gained some benefits. What did you gain by doing that?
You know, I no longer have to worry about so-called brothers plotting my death or me plotting theirs. You know, that's simplistic freedom. I guess physically, I'm no longer in a shoe. I'm still incarcerated. I'll probably remain incarcerated, although I'm eligible for parole.
I guess what I'm trying to get a gauge is, how's your day-to-day life different now?
Oh, I mean, my day's devoted towards different things. I read my Bible every day. And I'm not trying to hoodwink anybody to say that I am this reformed person or I am a rehabilitated individual. I'm not far removed from the individual I used to be. There are no swans in the cesspool. The only difference between me and those individuals is that I've chosen to extricate myself while they continue to wallow in it. So, you know, I'm really learning how to be a man again.
What's helping you with that journey to learn how to be a man again?
You know, there are a variety of individuals. My handlers, Mike Montgomery plays a large part in that, that he invested his trust in me. This recording became cathartic to me, therapeutic.
So what do you mean you when you did your audio diaries?
Oh, definitely. If you listen to the first audio diaries, I would not even speak in an emotional manner. It was just really, really mechanical. Mm-hmm. But Mike sat me down one day and told me, Renee, this is a chance for you to speak to yourself and speak to the world and teach them about really who you are and what this life is. It's something about a subculture that the public, general public, doesn't know about. So he made this not only a self-revelatory thing, but a self-educational epiphanous occurrence for me. And now my wife has a large part to do with it. Each step along the way, she teaches me when I go astray.
Your wife?
Yes, my wife. I'm married. I won't say her name. I don't want to disclose her name for security purposes. But there's one occurrence that I told Mike about one time. I was talking about past victims. And my wife becomes irate. And she says, how dare you speak about that individual that way? That was somebody's father. That was somebody's son. That was somebody's uncle. You know, you affected a lot of people other than that person that got killed. She says, how would you like it if somebody killed your son, Renee? How would you feel? It was at that moment, I got a lump in my throat. You know, if somebody had hurt one of my children, how I would feel.
That never crossed your mind before?
You have to become a hardened individual in the business. I mean, violence is our status mobility system. And it's a brutal world. Prison is a brutal world. It's a place where there's still place for weakness, for emotion, for consideration, for empathy.
Michael, I want to know, how have you seen Renee change over the past 3.5 years?
I think that the tape that Renee slowly starts compiling, these audio diaries, really reveal a multidimensional man, and a multidimensional man who was always there, but was really stuck in this dark, solitary world of gang secrets and of violence. One of the things I recall a prison official saying, who had known Renee, is saying that he had never seen Renee smile, ever, until he finally dropped out of the mob and started cooperating with authorities.
Renee, you eventually went from providing information to being a witness, which was not necessarily required of you. Why did you go further?
You know, There's so much that tips the scales against me. There's so much negative that I've done in my life. There's something positive that I can finally contribute to society. There's something I can do for the people that have put so much faith and trust in me. And it is an educational process for me. And it was just something that I could do that would be viewed as a successful pro-social contribution that I've made to society. There's something that I can give back. There's very little. I can't give lives back. I can't redeem what I've done.
You know, it sounds wonderful listening that you have had this epiphany. You're trying to change your life. But you killed people, and you're responsible for a lot of deaths.
Ultimately, I am responsible for quite a bit, acknowledging specific participation in specific acts I cannot do. But I think that would suffice to say that I'm a very bad man.
How are we supposed to react to you now?
You're right to be reserved in your judgment and even condemn me in some senses. There is going to be a large group of people that will never believe what I say, and that's okay. I'm not doing it for anybody's benefit but my own. Ultimately, if I serve a life sentence that I agreed upon, then that's what I merit, because those people did die. So if you never agree upon, you know, accepting me as a member of society, or a board, or a judge, or a district attorney doesn't, then that's fine. Ultimately, I have aspirations of being free one day, and I hope that comes to pass.
Michael, I want to ask you, if you were on the parole board and his case came before you, what would your decision be?
It's difficult for me to give an answer without hearing from what law enforcement say and what others say about whether or not Renee poses a danger to society. I think, given what I've seen with Renee, he certainly deserves a shot at parole. The critical factor, in my opinion, is whether or not he still poses a danger to society. Renee says he doesn't. I think in his current situation, he isn't a dangerous individual. It's difficult to say, if he's in society where he hasn't been in a long, long time, how he will respond and how he will respond to getting work that maybe doesn't challenge or stimulate him. But if I were on the parole board, I would want to look very, very closely at what the people, law enforcement agents and investigators close to Renee say. And if you talk to those people, quite a few of them say that they believe one day, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next year, but in a few years from now, if he stays on this current course, that he should be released and allowed to go back into society.
Michael, I want to thank you for being with us. And Renee, I want to wish you success in your journey.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and an experience.
There's a book about Renee Enriquez due out this fall. It's called The Black Hand. That's a reference to the tattoo of a black hand that all Mexican mafia members sport. You can follow the links on our website to hear the whole documentary, to see that tattoo of the black hand, and to read more about Renee. Go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now wherever books are sold.
Meat that doesn't involve animals and primaries that don't involve closure. Good news, bad news, no news? Coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe, along with Desiree Cooper. Well, it's a weekend. Finally, time to catch your breath after all the exciting events of the last week. Time to make some sense of it and sort it into categories you can understand for a segment we call Good News, Bad News, or No News. Joining us this week, Nancy French, author of A Red State of Mind. Hi, Nancy.
Hello, John.
Comedian, writer, bon vivant Dana Gould, whose credits include The Simpsons, among many others. Hi, Dana.
Present.
And joining us for the first time is Morgan Spurlock. You might know him from Super Size Me. He has a new documentary film out called Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden? Morgan, welcome.
Salam alaikum.
The long-anticipated Pennsylvania Democratic primary took place this week, and Hillary Clinton won by about 9 percentage points. Her supporters say it's a win that turns the tide. Meanwhile, supporters of Barack Obama point out that it didn't make much difference in terms of their man's overall delegate lead. Pennsylvania results, good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, as a Republican, I'd have to say it's good news. For two reasons. First, as they continue to slug it out publicly, it keeps giving us good material, good anecdotes like the Jeremiah Wright scandal, the insult about bitter rural people clinging to gods and guns, and the Bosnian helicopter sniper fire story. So that's the first reason. And secondly, it allows us to just have pure entertainment value in this election.
So that's as a Republican. How about as an American?
As an American, I'm going with bad news. I'm like, enough already. Let's end this thing. Let's get to the end of this race. I'm tired of it. Let's just get two horses out there and let's just, you know, come to the end of this whole process. As we go on and on, you know, McCain looks more and more sane.
Okay.
It does. To that end, it's almost no news because nothing has changed. You know, Hillary Clinton's campaign continues to say that Obama can't close the deal. But the reason he can't close the deal is because she's blocking him from closing the deal. So as a Democrat, it's kind of bad news. But as a human being, it's nice to know that certain things are always stable. The sun comes up every morning, Christmas comes every December, and the Democrats continue to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory.
How about the good news argument that it's generating a lot of interest? You know, viewership for the debate was really high. People are really excited about the political process. Does that make it good news?
I don't think so, because it's turned into a sludge fight. And as Nancy said, you know, basically they're doing the RNC's job for them.
And I got to tell you, as long as we keep debating really hot button issues like whether or not Barack Obama wants to wear a flag pin, then we're way on our way to, you know, changing this country.
But here's my other concern.
Yes.
You see the way the presidency ages people when you look at the way Bush was when he started and the way he is now. And you look at John McCain at the starting gate. By the end of his first term, he's going to be a brain in a fish tank.
There is a concern.
Important announcement from President Brain in a Fish Tank today.
He's going to look like the skeleton army from Jason and the Argonauts.
Well, Dana has a point. A few months ago, I would never have thought that McCain would have had such a good chance to win in November. But the Democrats slugging it out like this, they do give me hope, as they promise.
Right. Moving along, what if you could have meat without killing an animal or without even having an animal? The animal rights group PETA is offering a $1 million reward to anyone who can develop a commercially viable in vitro chicken meat product. But the food must not contain, quote, animal-derived products except for starter cells obtained in the initial development stages, unquote. Fake meat in a lab. Good news, bad news, or no news?
The name Soylent Green threw me.
Good news on the lab chicken, Dana?
Chickenstein? Sure.
Chickenstein.
Well, when you look at the food crisis, I think this is good. I know when you look at the oncoming, the cover of this week's The Economist has a very big story about the upcoming food shortage tsunami that the world is facing. And I think that anything is a good thing when it comes to producing food.
Chickenstein is good news. Morgan?
For years, there was the story that KFC had these labs where they would release these photographs, and they said, and the chickens, they don't even have wings or legs. They're basically just like these blobs with tubes stuck in them. And there was just like this image of, and it was like this internet story of this like pulsating, like throbbing kind of chicken thing just kind of sitting there growing on a shelf. So listen, I'm all for it. You know, it sounds like modern day technology helping us all.
So, Morgan, are you saying that it's no news because it's not all that different from the actual live chicken blobs grown on shelves that we have today?
I think that, you know, I think that the chicken blobs has been disproven. So for me, it's like, I think the jury's still out. So I'm going to go with potentially good news.
I would actually say it's no news for normal Americans who don't really have guilt about the chicken killing process.
We already have fields that are filled with genetically modified products that are vegetables. So are those okay? And the chicken isn't okay? I'm just trying to understand where scientifically we draw the line.
Yeah, I guess all of us draw arbitrary lines, but this chicken thing just seems like it just has this whiff of like going too far.
All right, let's move on to the next topic. Eat lots of nutrients while you're pregnant, you're more likely to have a boy. Eat light, well, it's a girl. That's according to a report from Oxford and Exeter Universities in England. Gender is still determined by chromosomes, but a study found that a woman's body with higher energy intake was more likely to develop a male embryo than a female embryo. Also, women who ate breakfast cereal, the study said, had more boys. Breakfast menus as gender predictors. Good news, bad news, or no news?
I'd have to say this is no news because it's so inconclusive. The way that they got their information is they asked first-time moms who'd just given birth to remember what they ate leading up to conception and the birth of their child. And number one, I don't think that people will admit to a bunch of scientists that they ate, you know, peanut M&Ms every day of their pregnancy, which is what I did, and I would never admit it to a scientist. And secondly, these moms are learning to breastfeed and changing diapers. They haven't slept. They don't remember what they ate. So I think these findings are just too inconclusive.
What Nancy forgot to mention was that baby was born in a delicious candy coating.
That's right. I had a very happy baby.
I'm with Nancy on this. I think it's no news. Every year you hear about how wine is good for you and you should drink more of it. Oh, no, you should drink less red wine. It's not good. It'll cause more heart problems. And I think that you can always find some data or some things that will back up whatever the idea is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to go with no news.
It's true. I'll give them 3 months to come up with a completely contradictory study. The methodology isn't tied to the results. It's like saying, crime has gone up since the death of the variety show. Well, I don't necessarily know if that's connected. Look at the murders when Carol Burnett was on. Look at them now.
So now, you're all very intelligent people here, but you're citing flaws in the research methodology of Oxford University.
From Oxford, Mississippi.
It's Oxford, Mississippi, yes.
I have a study here from DeVry that contradicts what you've just said.
Well, that's it for this week, and now it all makes sense to everybody. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Nancy French is the author of A Red State of Mind, How a Catfish Queen Reject Became a Liberty Bell. Dana Gould's credits include The Simpsons. Morgan Spurlock's documentary, Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden, is in theaters now.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Lines of constant longing find their way from Persia to the soul of a New York poet. Stay tuned to Weekend America.
Thank you.
We're here in St. Paul, Minnesota, welcoming you to the weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe. You know, the biggest sports event happening this weekend is for a sport that isn't even in season right now. It's the NFL draft, where pro teams take their pick of college players. Now, the top pick becomes an instant star, but the last pick of the entire draft, end of the seventh round, gets something kind of special, too. There's this group of people with money and a sense of humor who fly him to California, hold a parade, and crown him Mr. Irrelevant.
Oh, no.
It's kind of an honor. It's a weird little honor. So this weekend, after seven rounds and 2 days, someone becomes the new Mr. Irrelevant. The reigning Mr. Irrelevant is Ramsey Robinson. He was the last man picked in the 2007 draft. He went to the Lions of Detroit. He started watching the draft with his family, but after a while, he just couldn't stomach the wait. And I asked Ramsey about what draft day felt like for him.
It was frustrating. I just didn't want to let my brothers and sisters down, my family and friends. So I just had to go away. Like, I still, you know, came back home and couldn't go to sleep. Woke up Sunday. My mom sitting right there in front of the TV. I'm like walking through, looking at her like she's crazy. I'm like, Mom, find something else to do. Did you even take a shower or use the bathroom yet? You know, like I had to tease a little bit.
How did you find out you were picked?
My cousin came running out the house to give me a big old hug and said, you was finally picked. You got picked last in Detroit. Da, 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 da. So he gave me a big hug and everybody, you know, just ran outside yelling and stuff. And I'm still, you know, overwhelmed because, you know, I wasn't watching anymore. I was sitting outside on the car just thinking about stuff, you know, and you know, I was in tears, man. Like, I was truly in tears because it was bittersweet for me. Like, it, you know, it took forever and, you know, I wanted to get picked so bad. And when I finally did, you know, I mean, it was just incredible to see everybody's face. And so it was a very special moment, man. It's extremely hard to explain. And I hate that I missed my name go across the screen, though.
Well, how did you find out about this title of Mr. Irrelevant? How did you find out that you were Mr. Irrelevant?
Melanie Finch, who is the CEO of it, finally got in contact with me. And she was just ecstatic. Like, she was just so happy and just, I mean, she was talking so fast. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm not all that happy about being picked last. But she was like, I mean, she was more happy than my family was. She was telling me how they was going to have a lot of festivities out in California. So I'm like, all right, well, that's cool, whatever. You know, I'm just thinking she's just another a promoter or something that it probably felt sorry for me, you know, because I really didn't know that much about the whole Mr. Irrelevant title or the significance of it.
What was that weekend like? What did you do?
Oh, man, it was perfect. As soon as I got there, I was greeted at the airport. They had signs, man. They had T-shirts there. They had so many T-shirts made with my name on it and made me my favorite dish of macaroni and cheese. As soon as I got off the plane, they handed it to me. That was great.
They handed you a dish of macaroni and cheese at the airport?
In the airport, yeah. And it wasn't the best dish of macaroni and cheese, but it looked good. It looked real good. You know, the funniest thing about those festivities was when I went to the Angels game. Normally, you know, somebody of some significance, you know, they have them to do what? Throw out the first pitch, right?
Sure.
Okay, well, I'm thinking that's what I was going to do when I got to the game, you know, because they was like, oh, you're going to be sitting up in VIP in the lounge. And I'm like, oh, cool. I guess I'm going to, let me get my arm ready because I'm going to throw the first pitch. Yeah, right. Man, they sent me downstairs when it was almost time for me to go out. I had to drag the infield, man. So I'm out there getting my shoes dirty, trying to clean up the field between innings, man. And it was too funny. They had me on a big jumbotron, and they gave me a big shout-out, man. So it was great how they did it.
All right. Now, Ramsey, this weekend on Sunday, somebody else is going – you're going to hand over the title of Mr. Irrelevant to the 2008 Mr. Irrelevant. What advice do you have for that guy?
If I got to hand it over, my first advice is I'm going to say I apologize that I got to hand this over, but I got to give it to somebody. My second advice would be patient. They're not really expecting you to make it. So believe in yourself, have faith in your abilities, because nobody really is going to give you any credit for how good you might be or could be. The coach is going to forget your name sometimes. So you got to still believe, you know what, it's all right if you forgot my name, but I'm going to show you I'm just as good as that man. I'm better than this guy. So you got to let your play do your talking. Because it's going to be a struggle. So you got to be, you know, strong-minded to get through it.
Ramsey Robinson, 2007 Mr. Irrelevant, cornerback with the Detroit Lions. Ramsey, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. The pleasure was mine.
More information about past Mr. Irrelevance at weekinamerica.org. He also gets a trophy, the Lozman Trophy. Shows a guy fumbling a ball.
Oh, no.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Hope you're having a great weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with John Moe. You've heard of haikus, odes, limericks? All are poetry. But what about hustles? At first glance, the poem looks like a sonnet because it's in couplets, but that's where the similarities end. The hustle is a form of poetry rooted in the Middle East and India. Sometimes it's even sung. Suzanne Gardiniere has come to love the hustle. She's a writer and professor at Sarah Lawrence College in New York and has written a book called Today. It contains 101 original hustles. Suzanne will be reading some of them today at the annual Spring Sarah Lawrence Poetry Festival. The first thing to know about writing a hustle is how to say it.
When I'm working with my students on this forum, we practice that sound at the beginning, hustle, because often they'll say ghazal or ghazal. It's a form that originated in Arabic and Persian and moved into Urdu and is still very much a living tradition in those languages. And it's written in couplets. There's a repeated refrain at the end of each couplet called a radif. Put your fingers to my lips, will you, before I say something past forgiving. Tell me where your hands have been. Tell me what you've done that's past forgiving. I know someone who's free, but not here, past touch, past memory, past forgiving. The guards in lines try to take off their flesh and put on steel, past death, past forgiving. Your voice, a clear stream over gravel, laced with trembling, a hesitation between orchards, past forgiving. One way to describe the form is that each couplet is meant to be like a pearl in a necklace, so it radiates by itself and then it's beautiful with the other pearls at the same time. Your ankles pale on the couch, the day fading. Did you mean to show me what's past forgiving? The way your hips used to tell me the truth that is not the truth and is past forgiving. Those the guards touch strapped in ice and plastic, the faces on street posters, past forgiving. The emperor's loyal ones cheering, is this how our children will learn what's past forgiving? A woman with a photograph, her mother's face, which of them is past forgiving? Who's here? Your trespasser, blinder of witnesses, past purity, past famine, past forgiving. The word longing tends to be at the center of any discussion of what the ghazal is from its earliest roots. And sometimes it's personal longing, one person longing for another. Sometimes it's someone longing for justice in the country they live in. Sometimes it's a longing for God. Usually a sonnet would be, the conventional subjects of that would be love, death, and the changing of the seasons, as people say. But as an American working in the ghazal form, there was something different and interesting to me about the subject matter conventionally associated with the ghazal, with that longing that drew me to it. How had I grown so accustomed to moorings? Now your voice carries me from the slip to the sea. Dizzy, untied, beneath and above. Again tonight, carry me, the slip to the sea. One of the interesting paradoxes of the form to me is that while each couplet has to be different, there's a way that something has to hold them together. And really it's that meditation on the mystery of love, of what is it and what's the nature of experiencing it, and which of course you can't nail that. You can't make one couplet and say, okay, I got it. All you can do is circle around and around asking the questions. I'm used to the emperor's bitterness. I can't find the sweet place unless you make me. This face that is not my face, I may look made, but when you touch me, you make me. Make the oak say blossom, the stripped say swell, the avenue pavement say river. Make me. This shirt I can't take off, the one the nights without you gathered to make me. The new day, the sweet place, tomorrow, whispering from tonight's last light, make me. Kissing you without authorization, if you want me to stop, you'll have to make me. The ruined city, or is it a woman, interrupting your sleep to say now, to say make me.
Suzanne's book today includes 101 of her original hassles. She's waiting to read more of her lovely verses to you. Go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
This is the last weekend of April, which is National Poetry Month. Alimentum is a literary journal, and it's all about food. They chose to celebrate the month with food poetry. For the second year in a row, they distributed a menu of poems to New York restaurants and cafes, and we visited some of these dining establishments to see what people thought about getting their meal with a side of verse.
Oh, I think actually poetry and dining go very well together because both are composed of little morsels that you can shape and mold into even tastier items.
If I was to pick a favorite food to write about, one might be about ice cream.
Perhaps a poem about champagne and oysters, because it's such a wonderful combination and full of effervescence.
I would definitely, with no doubt, write about a kind of legume.
I'm going to read The Fork by Daniel Meltzer. Let us pause to consider the fork, without which we'd finger our pork, our egg and zucchini, anchovy weenie, at Maxim's or Sardi's New York. A marvelous simple device, essential to dining as spice. Invented in Switzerland by a man named Spitzer and patented later by Weiss. Spitzer died poor and anonymous, while Weiss drew praise unanimous. Invited to lecture, pontificate, conjecture on everything and anything gastronomous. A lesson is here demonstrated. You must protect what you have created. You need lawyers, accountants, and so on. Tine and tide, as we say, wait for no one. There, we've said it. Aren't you glad that you've waited?
Someone asked me once what my favorite cuisine was, and I had a really hard time not writing bread because I didn't want to be judged, but I love bread of all forms. Bread in stick form, bread in roll form, croissant bread, muffin bread, and regular sliced bread. And it's funny because my sister's ex-boyfriend gave me a bread maker in college, which I was, like, not sure. That was kind of like an intimate present to give someone who likes bread. But I never use it because I always made it by hand.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Bajo. We're here at the Smooch residence of coffee and organic, beautiful food. I'm here to read a poem called Bread by Alistair Reed. Such wonders, how the yeast will froth and flour. The flour begin to take on bulk and substance. The mass grow firm, forming under the fingers. The new dough sleek and smooth in the cool bowl. The waiting is a rich suspense. The rising almost too slow to see. With patience puffs into importance and assumes a shape. A pale bread embryo about to be. Now give it to the oven to become. Wait in the warm rise of anticipation. Breathe in the round aromas of the baking and spread your spirit in the smell of bread. This warmest, most rewarding ritual, this miracle, the good sense of bread.
I actually once had an English teacher. He made a metaphor between how grape juice is like prose. If you distill it and refine it, then it becomes more concentrated. And that's kind of what poetry is. It's kind of like choosing the smallest number of words to still effectively convey what you're trying to get the reader to feel and experience. And in a lot of ways, that's kind of like wine, because you start with a whole vineyard of grapes and you just end with one glass, and you have to tell the drinker a lot about where these grapes were made just in one glass of wine.
My name's Howard Altman, and I'm a poet, and I happen to be sitting here in Smooch Cafe. I've written a number of poems about food, and I'm going to read one now called Eating Strawberries. And how to paint absence on a summer afternoon in July, when the sun steals all the colors, lifting them up to some invisible plane, stretching out over the horizon. The way memory clouds the brain, the way shadows bleed into darkness. I just want to eat strawberries on her white sheets, and call it a day.
That was Eating Strawberries by Howard Altman. It wasn't an official title on the menu poems list, but we thought it fit the bill pretty well. We also heard The Fork by Daniel Meltzer and Bread by Alistair Reed. And now I'm very, very hungry. Check out all the poems at weekendamerica.org.
Speaking of poetry, John, you remember the poem that we learned as kids for our moms. M is for the million things she gave me.
O is for the other things she gave me. I can't remember how good. Well, anyway, Mother's Day is May 11th, and I think I need to go shopping with my kids for a gift for my wife. They like to give her things that they like. So Jill might be getting, action figures and Care Bears this year, I think.
I'm sure she'll love anything the kids give her. Well, we want to hear from you. What is your best Mother's Day gift ever? Were you the giver or the receiver?
Was it a new car or a new vacuum cleaner?
That's one I would not recommend.
We want to hear about it. Tell us about it and tell us what it meant to you.
If you have a photo of the gift, send it to us along with your response. On Mother's Day weekend, we'll include it on our website. That's at weekendamerica.org. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported this week that the region is still not out of danger of severe drought. Maybe Mother Nature's trying to make it up to them. All weekend, there's a chance of scattered storms in Atlanta. For more weekend weather, here's John.
The Kentucky Derby is weeks away, but Mangum, Oklahoma's Rattlesnake Derby is on now. How do they get those saddles fastened on there? Sun and 77 for snake charming, wrestling, and hunting, events you rarely see with racehorses. They also crowned the Derby Princess, a more harmless title than my suggestion, Queen of the Rattlesnakes. Meanwhile, contestants in Booth Bay Harbor, Maine, are competing for the title of Shrimp Princess. The Fisherman's Festival also features tug-of-war, tours, clouds in 55 degrees, and codfish relays. So it's just like the Olympics, but with dead fish instead of batons, and fishermen instead of athletes. And it's in Maine. Okay, it's nothing like the Olympics. Whether you love children's literature or love clinically depressed donkeys, Austin, Texas is the place to be. 83 degrees and appropriately big gloomy thunderclouds for Eeyore's birthday party. Music, costume contests, and refreshments, including pots of honey you eat with your hands. But only if you're a yellow cartoon bear of very little brain who wears no pants. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Okay, here's a riddle for you. What has 23 strings and doesn't sound anything at all like a banjo? A banjo. Get ready to listen with new ears, coming up on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
Well, if you're in Minneapolis and you're looking for something kind of interesting, or actually really interesting, to do this afternoon, you might want to swing by the Hosmer Public Library. Paul Metzger will be there playing the banjo, but a word of advice, don't show up expecting to hear your typical bluegrass music. In fact, don't expect to see your typical banjo either. Paul has spent over 20 years tinkering with the instrument, adding more and more strings. A banjo normally has 5 strings, and Paul's is up to 23 strings. This highly modified instrument of his has pushed the sound of the banjo to new limits.
The idea to have 23 strings on a banjo was not a single light bulb moment. Some banjos have a 5th string, a higher string, on the top end of it. Instead of just having a single accent string there, I added initially just one other one, and then a 3rd one, just to see what would come of those sounds, you know, and things that would further inspire me to add something else to the instrument or play it in a different way than is expected. When I first heard the instrument and I was interested in music, as far as a banjo goes, I liked the sound of the instrument more than the type of music that was being played on it. So I was listening to instruments from India and Iran and Afghanistan that have certain sounds that are really quite similar to what you can get out of a banjo or guitar if it's played in a certain way. So those were things that I was going toward, and being able to get an instrument like that, like to get a sarod from India, would mean going to India, you know. And as a young teenager, that wasn't really an option. So the idea of taking something that I already had access to, because the U.S. is just silly with banjos everywhere, it was just a very natural thing to do, and sort of take what's around and see where you can take it with what you're hearing in your head. To the circular body of the banjo, the drum part, that are used for tuning this set of strings. Then there are another 12 tuners up at the regular expected spot for an instrument up at the headstock. And they're for tuning the main melody strings, which are these. And then the 2 sets of accent strings, these 4 and these 3. It can be very percussive and exceptionally loud. I just dig that sound so much. Coconut shell, and it's really just like a thick piece of wood. I don't like to play with a piece of plastic. I actually lost this pick when I was touring and had to buy a coconut. And they're really hard to open up. We had to run it over with the tire of the car. And the street guy came out and started yelling at me about why was I running over a coconut. And I'm saying, well... I needed to make a pick for my banjo, and at that moment I just realized how ridiculous a lot of what I do is. I do look at myself as a bit of an evangelist for the instrument. I like to think that somebody might hear some of the recordings I've done and become interested in it as an instrument, hear the sounds of the banjo sort of with new ears, and to hear those kinds of tones, and to perhaps think of approaching it as something that can produce certain sounds rather than, oh, I think I'll learn how to play bluegrass music.
Paul and his banjo and all 23 strings on that banjo are going to be this afternoon appearing at the Hosmer Public Library in Minneapolis.
And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. The show is produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Jim Gates, Millie Jefferson, who's meeting her newborn cousin Jaden Smith this weekend, E. Okobi, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Tim Bomba, and Angela Kim, who's headed to the Minnesota Crafts Extravaganza this weekend.
Fun. Also, Rob Byers, thanks for the special monkey light in the studio, Rob. Susie Lechtenberg, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, who's participating in World Tai Chi Day today, David Banks, Phyllis Owens, and Mark Sanchez.
Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney, who's teaching his son Owen to count to 20 without skipping 15 and 16 this weekend. Jim Russell created the show. Get a free podcast of today's program at weekendamerica.org. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe. Have a great weekend.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. This program is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm on fire. And I think I'm ready to bust a move.
I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend.